Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. John Kelly's new book about the Irish potato famine is deeply researched, compelling in its details, and quite frankly, startling in its conclusions about the appalling decisions behind a tragedy of epic proportions. It started in 1845, and before it was over, more than 1 million men, women, and children would die. Another 2 million would flee the country. Measured in terms of mortality, the Great Irish Potato Famine was one of the worst disasters in the 19th century. It claimed twice as many lives as the American Civil War. A perfect storm of bacterial infection, political greed, and religious intolerance sparked the catastrophe. John Kelly is the author of the new book, The Graves Are Walking, The Great Famine, and The Saga of the Irish People. It is published by Holt, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Kelly to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. Give us a sense of what brought you to this subject of this great famine.
A question. I had read several other books on the famine. Being Irish American was a subject I was naturally interested in. The best of them, which was written over 50 years ago, remains Cecil Woodham Smith's The Great Hunger. But I never found a satisfactory answer to was, why did it happen? It seemed to me there was this deeper explanation than that the British were brutal, the Irish were poor and defenseless, one possible explanation, the other being an act of deliberate genocide in the way that, say, that the Ukrainian famine was deliberate genocide in the Soviets part, where Stalin literally ringed the Ukraine, wouldn't let anybody out, and took the food out and shot the people who tried to get out themselves. It seemed to me the famine was more complicated than that. And I spent 6 years researching this, and what I concluded is it was actually a failed attempt at nation building, 19th century version of nation building. Ireland was then the poorest country in Western Europe. It was also one of the poorest countries in the empire, and a great embarrassment and also a great expense to the British, to London, in controlling it. They had to keep a large number of troops there. There were almost every decade there were serious revolts. The economy, the British had harbored a plan for at least 20 or 30 years of how can we change Ireland, and what they'd come up with was the idea of changing the agricultural economy, making it a country of large farms, basically precursors of agribusiness, and reforming the Irish population, who were still had basically medieval values. There was no money economy in most of rural Ireland, which was about 80% of the country. There was no regular work ethic, and the British wanted to establish a system that would bring these things about. But they also, Ireland was full of 1, 2, and 3 acre farms, and in order to build this kind of agribusiness paradise, they had to get rid of all of these small farms. How do you do that in a normal time? You can't make those changes. They knew Ireland would arise in rebellion. You needed a weak point to implement change. In a funny way, it was almost what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism. At a moment of weakness, you impose strict controls. Mm-hmm. And that's what they use relief as instruments of change. Now, that's my main thesis. The book is also about the famine itself, what happened, the immigration, and there are plenty of individual stories of family suffering and anecdotes. But I wanted to put that, I had been looking for that overarching narrative, and that seemed to me to fit really what happened. In order to promote things like self-reliance, the Irish had to pay for their relief food. And in order for them to pay for their relief food, the British set up public works projects. If in order later in the famine, things worsened. In order to qualify for relief, small farmers, the people who they wanted to get rid of, had to agree to surrender their farms in order to get relief, to go into the workhouses. So there was this, basically, and they wanted to reduce the population. And there was a feeling that Ireland, which had a population of 8.5 million, could only thrive with 6 million people. And there had been plans for immigration for 30 years before the famine, and the British could never figure a way of doing it. And lo and behold, in 10 years, the population was reduced by a third. So between death and immigration, there were at least 2 million immigrants. Ireland went from a nation of 8.5 million in 1845 to, in 1855, a nation of about 6 million.
So as you point out, basically the problem is you have this relief program that is more concerned with change,
right,
and fostering
exactly.
change than saving the lives of the people who are dying.
That's exactly it. That's my whole point. And I think that's one of the things that really struck me about this as I got into it, because I really wasn't expecting it, is how much it resonated with the arguments we're having these today. I mean, I think you can really make a case that the modern arguments about taxes, which is immigration, and the role of government in our lives began in Ireland, the modern arguments, because the British did not want to, the British did not want to tax their people to pay for the relief. So they fostered, also as part of the self-reliance, they transferred after the first year. There were 2 years of major crop failures, 1845 and 1846. In 1845, the British did help pay for some of the relief, but in 1846, which was the year that there was a much more serious crop failure, 90% of the potato crop, which the vast majority of the people lived on, failed, and there was no substitute food. At that point, the British transferred the cost of paying relief to the Irish. And you had a poor landed class which couldn't afford it, and you just had people starving.
You write that in the last conquest of Ireland, John Mitchell, a founding father of modern Irish nationalism, depicted the British officials who presided over the famine as genocidal gargoyles. You say they were not.
They were not. And I also say that's what makes them so frightening. By their own lights, they were decent, God-fearing men. They honestly believed they were doing the right thing for Ireland, i.e., they were going to modernize it and bring it into the 19th century, and by creating an education system and by incalculating the values of the new industrial age into a peasantry that was still medieval in character, that still bartered and didn't use cash, that didn't have the same sense of enterprise or self-reliance, they felt, as the British, as the average Briton. And this in theory, was a noble goal, but it's a bad idea to try something that large in the middle of a famine and to use relief measures as instruments of social change. I mean, it's actually crazy.
So you have good people, and then you mix in religion, you mix in politics,
right,
and you got trouble.
Exactly. These people really believed what they were doing. I mean, in a funny way, the mindset, the analogy I would use is the mindset of the officials in the Bush administration and the run-up to the Iraq War. I mean, most of those people really believed what they were doing was correct. There are a lot of people who said it wasn't, but they believed it in their heart of hearts, and whatever one thinks of people like Dick Cheney, they weren't genocidal gargoyles.
Mm.
And it just moved that mindset back 150 years, and you have the people in Whitehall who oversaw famine relief. This same belief, and what's dangerous about it is the inflexibility of that belief. the unwillingness to allow empirical evidence from. I mean, there were British relief officers in Ireland. They were sending back frantic letters saying mass death is setting in from starvation, and they ignored it until the last moment. Finally, after mass death had set in, and at least a half million people had already died, the British decided to stop charging people for food, stop making them work for it because they were starving to death, just set up a nationwide network of soup kitchens, and the starvation and the mass death stopped on a dime.
And not to mention, after at the end of this, for well, maybe even still, creating a distrust of England by the Irish.
Once Ireland at that there was the Anglo-Irish Union, which started was formed in 1800. Ireland was part of the UK and remained so until 1922. Any chance of Ireland ever becoming integrated in the way that Scotland and Wales became integrated into Britain ended with the famine. That was it. There was no, prior to the famine, there were uprisings, there was violence, but there was always the possibility that somehow that union might gel. After that, there was, I believe, this is my opinion, that the Irish realized they would never remain under the Britain, under a British flag, never. That meant independence, and it also meant, in terms of immigration, that they would come to the United States in much greater numbers than they would go to Canada.
You read this story, I read the story, and I got to the end, and I looked, and I thought to myself, there's no reason why this can't happen again.
No. There is absolutely... All modern famines are not the result of an absolute shortage of food. They are a result of what one scholar calls entitlements. Who has access to food? Who makes the decisions about how food is distributed? And that who that person is, that group decides is worthy of receiving the food and is not worthy of receiving it. That happens in it has happened in a number of these. Somalia is a perfect example of it. There was plenty of. There was one period in the autumn of 1846 where there may have been. This is after the second crop failure, when 90% of the potato crop was destroyed, where there may have been an absolute shortage of food for a few months. But in the worst period of the famine, those 9 months. Ireland imported five times more food than it exported. So that's one of the Irish nationalist myths about it turns out not to be true. So what really mattered was the people who decided who was entitled to it and who was not. And the way they did that was by charging for food.
President Bill Clinton says of the book, John Kelly gives heartbreaking detail to the Great Famine that seared itself into the memory of the Irish people and sheds fascinating new light on the policy decisions that made it even worse. The graves are walking as a cautionary tale for all who would risk calamity, human, economic, or ecological, in the name of scoring an ideological victory. The book is The Graves Are Walking, The Great Famine and the Saga of the Irish People. It is published by Henry Holt. John Kelly, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Great pleasure. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.